I go down to the edge of the sea. How everything shines in the morning light. The cusp of the whelk, the broken cupboard of the clam, the opened blue mussels, moon snails, pale pink and barnacle scarred, and nothing at all whole or shut, but tattered, splits, dropped by the gulls onto the grey rocks, and all the moisture gone. It's like a schoolhouse of little words, thousands of words. First, you figure out what each one means by itself, the jingle, the periwinkle, the scallop, full of moonlight. Then you begin slowly to read the whole story. Welcome, friends, to our Wednesday theme talk. I'm here in person, as you've noticed, and Fiona is going to magically appear on screen in due course. I'm Lizzie, I'm training for ministry, I'm from the Framlingham congregation, and I'm standing here in an unnecessarily large green shirt. I'm a white woman with long brown hair and just a tiny bit nervous. Just as we have gathered from all over the country, and already this week become so much more than the sum of our parts, so too do the years of our lives gather to tell our unique tales. And so too do the fragmented parts of ourselves gather themselves up into something beautiful and whole. Fiona and I are here to explore that transformative process of gathering up and making the self. And we kind of like to think of this talk like a patchwork. We've pulled together the words and the images and the music that have meant the most to us. But in essence, it's ourselves, that ineffable thing that emerges from the sum of our experiences that we share with you today. I'm going to invite Ivy and Connie to come up together completely equally and not in any way fighting over this to light our chalice. Just before you do, guys, we're going to light the chalice with these words from Nancy Schaffer. They speak to that same process of seeing the whole story, of mending and healing through creating wholeness, of pulling the broken parts of ourselves together. Right, ladies. Namaste, Ivy and Connie. This making of a whole self takes such a very long time. Pieces are not sequential, nor are supplies. We work here and then there, holding up tattered fabric to the light. We sew past dark, intent, use all our thread. Sometimes sleeves come before length, buttons before the rounded neck. We sew at what needs us most, and as it asks, we sew again. The self is not one thing. Once made, unaltered, not midnight task alone, not after other work. It is everything. Everything we come upon and make ours, all this fitting of what once was and will become. And so we turn to our story. When I read that first reading, and of course it's about the sea, all the beautiful, it's like this is the weirdest seaside scene that I've accidentally created. Our story is called St. Francis and the Wolf, and it's acted by anybody who at this moment feels that they want to be part of the story. I'm really hoping that we have a St. Francis who's still up for this. Would you like to maybe stand up just at the front, St. Francis? And in fact, I'd like you to gather as many of your animals together into your arms as possible. This is the story of St. Francis and the Wolf. St. Francis and the Wolf of Gubbio. Oh, no. This is Francis. I don't know what animal that is. St. Francis was known throughout the land for his gentle and healing manner. Even the wildest animals responded to his divine and gentle light. And here they all are. There's slightly more than I thought there would be. St. Francis, that might be enough if you'd like. You've got some acting to do, and I don't want you to feel like burdened. St. Francis, everybody. Listening up? St. Francis was staying in the town of Gubbio, and he learned of a wolf that was stalking the town. Where's my wolf? Wolves. Stand up over here, please. The wolf over here, not near me, don't eat me. The wolf was so ravenous. It was not only killing people, not only killing and eating animals, keep them safe, Francis, but people too. The townspeople over here, are you feeling quite scared already? Wolves, come and eat a townsperson. You can choose who to eat. Be gentle. Okay, that's enough eating, wolves. Ezra's now a wolf as well. They're like zombie wolves. Townspeople, Anushka and Ro, this is you. Some people took up arms. That means they got into the kind of fighting zone. And they went after the wolf, of which there are two of them for no reason. But, oh no, don't, the wolf's glasses were quite expensive. Wolves and town people, there's something very important that I need to tell you. Some of the townspeople encountered the wolf and fought the wolf, and they perished with its sharp teeth, I know. Others pretended the wolf didn't exist, which meant it leapt out at them when they least expected it. And still others were so fearful that they never even risked leaving the safety of their houses. Can you look very scared, townspeople? I would be scared. Francis did none of those things. Francis decided to go out and meet the wolf. So many stories had grown up around this wolf or wolves that he decided he needed to face it. Francis, and as many animals as you see fit, please come and meet the wolf. And wolf, you get to be really scary. I'm glad you've got a lion with you. That will help. Suddenly... Freeze. Oh, I've got three wolves now. Suddenly, the wolf leapt out at St. Francis, jaws agape. You can't do this because you're holding loads of animals, but Francis made the sign of the cross. He looked deep into the wolves' eyes. He did not try to kill or fight the wolf. He did not run away. He did not give in to his fear. He did not pretend it wasn't there. He called out to the creatures, wolves, Come to me,
come
Brother
to
Wolf.
Me.
Brother Wolf. I order you not to hurt anyone.
I order you not to hurt anyone.
Strangely enough, having faced the wolf, wolves, you now need to look very tame and lovely and lie on the floor and not distract anyone. The townspeople are just already just instinctively much happier. The wolf lowered its head and lay down at St. Francis's feet, meek as a lamb. Well done. I don't really know what's happening down here. Francis explained to the wolf that he'd been terrorising the people, killing not only animals but humans, all of whom are made in the image of God. Brother Wolf, said Francis.
Brother Wolf.
I want you to make peace.
I want you to make peace.
With the people of Gubbio.
With the people of Gubbio.
They will not harm you.
They will not harm you.
If you do not harm them.
If you do not harm them.
All past crimes are to be forgiven. For some reason, St. Francis just isn't on board with that. The wolf showed its assent by moving its body and nodding its heads. And then, and this is the important bit, so we need absolute concentration. Francis asked the wolf to make a pledge, a promise. He extended his hand to receive the pledge, and the wolves extended their paws and placed them in the saint's hand. Francis commanded the wolf to follow him into the town to make a peace pact with the townspeople, and the wolf meekly followed St. Francis. You can just stay there, though. By the time they got to the town square, everyone was there to witness the miracle. With the wolf at his side, he offered the townspeople peace on behalf of the wolf. The townspeople promised in a loud voice to feed the wolf. Francis asked the wolf if he would live in peace under those terms. He bowed his head, he twisted his body, and convinced everyone he had accepted the pact. I've got a pack. Then once again, the wolf placed its paw in St. Francis' hand as a sign of the pact. From that day on, the townspeople and the wolf kept the promise they'd made. The wolf lived for 2 years among the townspeople, going from door to door for food. I don't know what it was eating, if it wasn't like the people or animals. It hurt no one. No one hurt it. Even the dogs didn't bark at it. The wolf died of old age. And all the people were sad. You can die of old age, guys, if you want. The wolf's peaceful ways were a living reminder of the wonders and the patience and the virtues and holiness of St. Francis and the peace that comes when even a wolf can live peacefully with you, a living symbol of grace. Thank you, everybody. You can choose a toy to hold, and that's open to anyone. I'm going to hold this lion for a minute. Actually, you can't take me seriously if I've got a lion under my arm, can you? Francis of Assisi is someone who has inspired Fiona. And it was Fiona who suggested that we tell the story of St. Francis. And in a moment, on her behalf, I'm going to read a poem that she wrote about St. Francis, the image of the quiet healer, but more importantly, the healer who mends broken things, broken animals and broken hearts, whose small acts of love mended his world. I chose to do the bit about the wolf, because I really like the way the townsfolk try to fight or hide from the wolf and how much suffering it comes from that resistance. Whereas Francis faces the wolf, and in making peace with the wolf, the wolf lives quietly in the town and in some way makes it whole. Small people, I'm going to read this poem and then we're going to sing and then you can take as many of your toys as you possibly can out, or you can leave them here to listen to the rest of the story. This is Friar Francis by Fiona Owen. He carries it in his eyes, the trickle of tributary swelled to deep river that's wended through thicket and briar, disappeared long years deep underground, only to bubble out into open pasture at last. His face shows he knows the way. Life hardnesses can and do knock bits off us all, spoil the ideas we were enthralled to, ideals of perfection, those palaces of glass we start off with and that have to shatter to let us into the flow. Same goes for the trajectories we thought were ours. Live the life that's yours, goes the chorus, not the one you thought was yours. So learn softness in the face of stone hearts, pliability in the face of stone minds, flow in the face of set. Loving the creaturely as thyself is the best bet, calling them brother, sister, father, mother, even the sun, even the moon, even this patch of earth you call you. And now we sing. It's in the Purple Book, 111, Oh Brother Sun, St. Francis wrote the lyrics. But you don't need the book because the lyrics are going to appear behind me. In fact, maybe they already have. And kids, if you want to make your move, that's fine. I didn't know Fiona until we started planning this service together. But we find, as we speak, that we have a lot in common. Fiona and I are both people who have been broken and put back together again. And maybe that's true of everyone here. And that's why we chose our theme, finding our religion through the gathering of the self into a wholeness that transcends its many holy fragments, because we thought it might resonate with you. Like Fiona and I, perhaps some of you have also been taken apart and sewn back together in a literal sense, perhaps under the knife of a surgeon or treated in hospital for a serious illness. And if so, you'll know a little of the very particular sense of vulnerability that comes from that experience. Fiona will tell her story soon, and both of us have the scars, and perhaps you do too, the ones with the little tiny dots down the sides where you've literally been sewn back together. I'll leave Fiona to tell her tale. But both of us have found ourselves in illness and in healing, in embodied vulnerability, in the putting back together of ourselves, and in our turn, helping others to do the same. There are many strands to my story, and actually many reasons why I have that felt sense of physical vulnerability that I carry within myself. My medical history is just one of those strands. And the medical story goes like this. My spine was significantly curved to the point of being disabling. And I wore a brace and then had very, very major surgery in my teens that straightened my spine. And now my body is held in a shape that isn't where it was going. I kind of had to change direction. In fact, my body, after all these years, after 30 years, it was 1995, the same year that summer school started, is still held in a new and unfamiliar shape, and it's left me in pain. And it's that part of my story that I'm sharing now. It's the act of sharing and revealing that vulnerability that my story is told, and it's also in the act of sharing that the healing happens. And the reason why I think sharing our stories is so healing is because so many of our stories are also stories of shame. And shame is a big, big word, I know. My story is a story of shame and of grace. And the grace comes from you, my Unitarian friends. Shame and grace, I prefer to call it mud and sunshine. I wrote this, as some of you know, yesterday, because actually I knew I was going to do this, and I just needed to get to a point where I had to. My gut instinct after many years of thinking and writing about shame is that it's not spoken of half as much as it should be. And that's because shame in itself thrives in the shadows. I wonder if somewhere deep down you feel some residual shame. And I wonder if you're not always able to spot it because we so rarely talk of it. When you make a mistake and you know that it was a bit daft, that's not a great feeling. Maybe that's what we would call embarrassment, that kind of, oh, why did I do that? And it can feel a bit uncomfortable. And when you do something wrong, and you know it was wrong, and it's fallen short of your moral standards, that feels even worse. And that might be what we call guilt. But if you do something wrong, make a small mistake, or embarrass yourself, or fall short of your standards, and then you turn it on yourself, and you say, I always do that, I am inherently flawed, I'm inherently wrong, I'm broken and not deserving of generosity and grace, that is shame. The difference is that feeling embarrassed or guilty is contained in the behaviour or the situation, and shame is global, and it can be catastrophic. And I know people whose lives have been broken by shame, absolutely broken by a sense of inherent wrongness and brokenness. It's catastrophic, I think, because it's related to the very essence of ourself. And I think my instinct is that more people feel more shame than they let on. It's actually all too easy to go from, I didn't get that one thing in the theme talk, so I'm inherently stupid. I'm having a terrible hair day, so I must be fundamentally unattractive. And given that we all share this tendency, I thought I'd just tell you what I figured out so far about shame, about the mud, and what I figured out about grace, the sunshine, that light and love of acceptance and community. I don't know about you, but I'm a great believer in the idea that we're made up of various parts and kind of versions of ourselves. Parts of me include grown-up, confident talker, remembering not to wave my hands around too much, remembering to talk loudly, taking responsibility, doing things properly. I'm also a very sensible, conscientious homeowner. I'm a mother. I'm a risk taker. I also have an inner critic. I also have an inner child. I think shame might be one of the parts of the self, and if you want, you can think of it like the wolf in the story. And I think sometimes with shame, we either fight it, or we run away from it, or we pretend it's not there, and then it jumps out at us and gets us when we're least expecting it. I wonder if shame, like lots of other parts of the psyche, might come partly in childhood. I'm thinking of a little person making a mistake and being told off. And they don't really get what they've done wrong. And if they're not in a very safe or loving place, a safe and loving relationship with the person who has told them off, they're not really able to face their mistake. They might try and push it away. I didn't do that, I didn't do that. They'll try and bury it under the mud. Because you know and I know as grown-ups that the best thing you do when you get something wrong is to say, yep, I messed that one up. I got it wrong. I broke whatever it was I broke. I struggled to understand that. I got my spellings wrong, my homework wrong. I said the wrong, terrible thing to the wrong person. And admit it. But to do that is a risk. You can only really truly admit your minor flaws if you feel overall safe and loved and held. And when it goes right in childhood, you make a little mistake and someone says, that's okay, it's no big deal. You dropped the glass or you fell over or you spelt that wrong or you said that daft thing. But I love you just as you are. You, yourself, the whole person who made the mistake, you're fine. You're a person who made a mistake. There's no shame there. But if only life were that simple. I think the problem is for all of us that the opposite of that happens. And I think some people who carry a lot of trauma, that happens over and over again. Little people make mistakes and no one tells them to face up to it and say, yep, got it wrong. And so their brains go a-whirring and they start saying, you got that wrong because you are wrong. You made that mistake because you are stupid. You broke that because you are broken. And I think all grown-ups have a bit of inner shame that sounds a bit like that. And a voice that says, you better hide that. Hide the shame. Don't let people see it. My little shamed person hid for a long time under the mud. And I wonder if a part of you that feels that you are wrong and not good enough or not lovable enough is also hiding under some of your own mud. Finding my religion has been so wonderfully simple to put into words and it has been a bit harder in practice. I dug into the mud. I found the part of myself that was hiding in shame, hiding in the mud with a sense of not being good enough, not even being good enough to be seen. I dug right down and I let in the sunshine, and it shined and it warmed that part of me. It tamed the wolf. The wolf came to live with all the other parts of me in the village. And I did that because I finally felt safe in relationship. And I felt safe in relationship because I found a community of people who told me over and over again that I was allowed to show up as I am. And it's you I'm talking about. I believed you when you said it. I believed it. I suggest that the grace I encountered in the Unitarian community is part of a very long-standing and distinctly Unitarian view of human nature. In fact, I think that when I became a Unitarian and found acceptance, what was actually happening was a kind of theological alchemy. Our ideas as a community about human nature have at least a 250-year-old heritage. When our Unitarian forebears started making theological claims centered on our goodness rather than our sinfulness. And I think that was rooted in their very brave and bold ability to hold their own religious shame in the light. I think my experience, although I do not carry religious trauma, my experience of acceptance and grace and sunshine can be traced right back to the birth of our movement as a reaction to the doctrine of original sin. Despite the name of our denomination, which suggests, of course, the unity of God and the rejection of the Trinity, I would suggest it's actually more useful for us finding our religion in the 21st century to have a look at reading the movement as stemming from a deliberate shift in our understanding of human nature. And the rejection of the Trinity came second to that. It was actually in many ways born out of a very rationalist shift to this idea of the human mind as something created to move towards the good, rather than fall into the depths of depravity and sinfulness. And a model of the human character as capable of great moral progress. I've noticed that legacy everywhere. And I think our movement still heals people because our movement is founded on an idea, a claim about human nature, that at the end of the day, we're kind of all right, really. I see it in the hidden work we do in our congregations. I see it as a theological claim underpinning our work around LGBT+ rights, acceptance of neurodiversity, celebration of difference in every way. And I see lots of people carrying shame who walk into our congregations and find wholeness. And I think we do it particularly well. I often hear fellow Unitarians talk of original blessing rather than original sin. And actually, I think that they embody this blessing in many of their congregations. For people who visit and people who stay, it is the foundation of their transformation. For me, it is the primary ingredients in the alchemy of church. And I love just how many of our gathering words and our chalice lightings and our hymns say, show up just as you are, that speak of acceptance, of authenticity, and of being vulnerable together. And I love that our emphasis, which 250 years ago was about moral perfection, is now almost the opposite. By saying we could be perfect, we're saying we could also just be as we are, you know, flawed and messy. If you say you have the potential for perfection, that's enough, isn't it? And of course, then it relates to the rejection of the Trinity. Because what does 250 years of illuminating the good humanity of Jesus looks like? Well, it looks like this. The warmth and the love and the authenticity, the emphasis on congruent, real relationships with all the flaws and the wonderful messiness. It saves us all more than any substitutionary sacrifice or atonement for sin. It saved me. 250 years ago, 300 years ago, our Unitarian ancestors were finding their religion in a completely different view of humanity. They didn't know where that would lead. But we do, because it's here. They didn't know that many, many years later, people would find healing from religious shame in the same way that they did. I think that is our direct inheritance, and it is a way of finding religion in the 21st century. The humanness, the warmth, the realness of Jesus and you. And so finally, what of my shame, which is not religious shame? This is not a big conversion story. I didn't grow up in a religious house. I never became a militant atheist or a fundamentalist believer of any kind. I was just kind of fine. but I wasn't, was I? I wasn't, because the wolf was there and I did really well at pretending it wasn't, until one day it came up and bit me and I really, really needed a safe relationship with a community that said it's okay not to be perfect. The healing moment for me comes from being very gentle with myself and with other people, gradually lifting myself from the mud and other people, and helping people find their way into the sunshine. And it feels really good to have people who see me for who I really am and know that. And I'm practicing letting go of shame and assimilating that difficult part into the whole picture. I think that is grace, and I'm really happy to use that theological term. It has been my salvation. Holding myself in the light, dissolving the mud, reaching down and finding a lost child in the bog to be held and warmed up and loved again. A process of being saved. Grace as a process of being loved over and over and over again. And now I feel safe. I can say to myself, yep, I made a mistake. It's not a catastrophe. It's not the end of the world. It's not a global statement about my very identity. I'm just a very normal person who made a small mistake that day. I embarrassed myself, or I dropped something, or I forgot something, or I said something ridiculous to someone. And it's okay, because I have recreated the relationship, that ideal relationship that I spoke of at the start. Things now go right for me. I'm not shaken to the core anymore. And what about you and your shame? Well, I think as long as you can hold yourself in the light and see yourself as whole and integrated and embraced by the grace of yourself, of the divine, of our beloved community, if you can see the power of love moving through the world, something ancient and universal, a heartbeat, the spirit and the divine breath moving across time, if you can see yourself as part of that whole story, I think you too can find grace and find your way out of the mud and into the sunshine. Our musical interlude, to allow you to process that, is a short song that was written by Fiona. It's called Marigold, and Jane is going to share it.
No getting away with it. Though you try. There is no escaping it. Though you try, this is where your place is, and here are people who love you, and every day that comes brings new possibilities. And look at the way the marigold opens up to the morning sun, and all day long she sings her song of here. And when the night comes, she folds herself into a prayer. And the dark rolls around her, but at daybreak she's waiting to fly, to catch whatever.
What with the beautiful poetry about St. Francis and the music, that Fiona is a super talented human being, and it's been my absolute pleasure to get to know her. And now I'm going to hand over to Fiona, who has recorded her talk for you.
Hi everyone, I'm Fiona. I'm beaming in from Ynys Môn, Anglesey in the north of Wales. It's a real pleasure to be sharing some thoughts with you today at the 2025 Hucklow Summer School. And thanks to the Summer School organisers for inviting me to share this session with Lizzie, who has been an absolute joy to work with in co-creating this morning service. I'm going to talk from both personal experience, and I'll be weaving in a range of other voices with the hope that some of this theme of transformation and growing into ourselves, into wholeness, will resonate with you. Our particulars may be unique for every life, but there are always common factors and deeper themes we all share in one way or another. So I'm just going to share my slides. So I'm going to disappear while I'm running through the slides, and then I'll be back at the end to say bye-bye. Okay, so I'm just going to share my screen. Okay. And there we go. I can probably play from the start. There we go. All right. So, on being a well, I tend to picture us as little wells. Each individual well is fed by the same mysterious deep water source. I like this analogy too because of the word well. It resonates for me and how I feel when I'm well hydrated, as it were, inwardly, when my life feels sappy, when my inner well feels topped up with life-giving water from the deeps. Wellness doesn't always or necessarily equate with having perfect health, I'd like to suggest, speaking personally. We can be good enough, well enough physically, but Being of good heart to me is the thing. And I've called this talk, you know, thaseo, and it's an ancient Greek word. It means to be courageous, to be of good cheer, or to take heart. And this ancient Greek word, it was used in the New Testament, and it's associated with things Jesus is alleged to have said when encouraging and reassuring others in times of fearfulness. The word tharseo is a kind of galvanizing call to action, drawing on the warmth of the heart. And heart is linked etymologically to courage from the Latin word cor. The old French courage referred to the feelings and strength and warmth associated with the heart. The word is linked with courage from the French word cœur. In Welsh, canol means centre, calon means heart. Just same letters, just in a different order. The heart then is our seat of courage, and we need courage almost every day in small ways and on some days in big ways too. So tharseo is quite a nice thing to wish others as well as oneself. And the feel of being a full well links me to feeling also full of heart, with a sense of depth and expansiveness. When using the imagery of wells and the heart, of course I'm speaking metaphorically, and I'll be bringing in a whole variety of metaphors as I proceed. The poet David White has a poem called The Well, and this is just an extract of it, but I feel that he puts it well, and it contrasts with a feel of aridity and soul drought instead of finding inner quenching and glossy hydration. Be thankful now for having arrived, for the sense of having drunk from a well, for remembering the long drought that preceded your arrival, and the years walking in a desert landscape of surfaces, looking for a spring hidden from you so long that even wanting to find it now had gone from your mind, until you only remembered the hard pilgrimage that brought you here. The hard pilgrimage. So White, using this imagery of the well, of slaking a spiritual thirst and of life as pilgrimage, reminded me of that sense of arriving at last, as White says. Reminds me that when we arrive, we never really stay put. We're then moving on again. We always seem to get called onwards, as T.S. Eliot says in this extract. You know, we arrive as if knowing the place for the first time. So it seems to be ever onward. So back to the ancient Greeks, where so much of our English language comes from. They have this wonderful term, eudaimonia, and it means flourishing. It's associated with fulfilling one's potential and living a meaningful life. And it goes back, you know, to those Greeks, Plato, Aristotle, Epicurus, just a few of them, but the big names, right at the start of Western philosophy, where they were asking questions like, how do we best live? How can we best flourish? And this term, eudaimonia, brings to mind a sense of feeling balanced, in tune, in good spirits, in right relationship with others, and importantly, with our daemon, our inner intelligence or soul. And let's remember too that the word philosophy itself means love, that's the philo or philo part, of wisdom, Sophia. And so this is loving the life that advocates for the good, the true, and the beautiful. And as a poet, I've always loved the way that we can glimpse worlds within worlds just from a few well-placed, apt words, which is what William Blake, the English poet, he wrote in his famous Auguries of Innocence. You'll all know this, this little quatrain. To see a world in a grain of sand and a heaven in a wild flower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand and eternity in an hour. So he's recognizing that from the tiniest particles we can kind of see a whole world, the macrocosm in the microcosm and vice versa, as within so without, as above so below. These are perennial ideas. And in the East we get feng shui, don't we, which again is about the inner relationship, the inner and outer relationship, you know, how we're affected by one on the other. So the idea that we can know the whole from paying attention to the parts, that's there in Mary Oliver's poem, Breakage. And I'll come on to that shortly. But also you'll know that Leonard Cohen sings, "The crack is how the light gets in." So this kind of theme of brokenness as being very much part of life, being broken and then healing, mending, growing. And Henri Nouwen, he claimed that we can become healers from being ourselves wounded. He talks about the wounded healer. Nobody escapes being wounded. We're all wounded people, whether physically, emotionally, mentally, or spiritually. The main question is not how can we hide our wounds, see them in us in some way, a kind of shame, shamefulness, embarrassment, but rather how can we put our woundedness to the service of others? When our wounds cease to be a source of shame and become a source of healing, we have become wounded healers, which I personally find a very encouraging idea that tests well against my own experience. So we can learn, not always that we do learn, but we can learn from our experience, and we learn from the bits and pieces, the parts of life that we encounter. We learn about wholeness through the bits and the bric-a-brac, if you like, of life as we meet it. And that is what Mary Oliver is saying in her poem Breakage. This is just an extract where she goes down to the edge of the sea. She's noticing and naming all the little bits and pieces that are there in her beautiful language. And she says, it's like a schoolhouse of little words, thousands of words. First you figure out what each one means by itself, and then you begin slowly to read the whole story. So life's process then makes us tattered, split, and yet, as Mary Oliver says, we're all part of an inscrutable whole that we can learn to read through its parts. We learn. We're disciples of life. Blake calls everything that lives holy, and that might be quite a claim, but it does serve as a reminder for us to take a little step back from our habituated, world-weary vision and relationship with life and cleanse our sense of perception. And to me, he's also talking about the kind of attention we need to pay the world and us in it. Do we believe the kind of, you know, those stories that claim to be true, that we are merely matter, we're mere surfaces? Or are there other stories available that are less dogmatic and that actually speak in terms of mystery and openness and the fact that here we are and gosh, wow, what a miracle that is. And I am kind of approaching some of this myself in this poem, Friar Francis. I must say that Saint Francis is a favourite saint of mine. I love his inclusive, everything is brother, sun, sister, moon, and all of the animals as part of the kindom, KIN, kindom. And that's me putting a spin on it there. But I'm kind of doing something similar. I'm acknowledging that wisdom doesn't, it doesn't come easy. And somebody like, I was imagining Saint Francis's wisdom, it comes by being a wayfarer, really. His face shows he knows the way. Life's hardnesses can and do knock bits off us all, spoil the ideas we are enthralled to, ideals of perfection, those palaces of glass we start off with that have to shatter to let us out into the flow. And this brings me very much to the Japanese concept, aesthetic of wabi-sabi, where beauty is seen in the wonky, the irregular, the natural, the word wabi indicating things that are rustic, simple, unflashy, and the sabi meaning beauty that comes from age, being weathered, showing natural wear and tear, and so on. And to me, it's a beautiful orientation. It's one that honours the aesthetic qualities of ordinary things, and it reminds us that such an aesthetic is created from paying attention. And kintsugi, the Japanese, again, it's allied to wabi-sabi. And it talks about golden joinery. The word means golden joinery or golden repair, where broken pottery, it's not thrown away, it's mended in a way that tries to, it shows the break. It highlights the break by using urishi lacquer that's dusted or mixed with powdered gold, silver or platinum, as you can see in the image. And breakage isn't therefore something to kind of try and disguise or be ashamed of, but it's something that is made golden, which I think is such a lovely approach. And from my own life experience, I've found this kind of approach can really help us navigate life in a much more realistic way when we ourselves feel very broken in various ways. And having an aesthetic regard towards life's 10,000 things brings with it an ethical stance whereby the ancient trinity of the good, the true, and the beautiful is brought into play and upheld, perhaps because love gets involved. For me, and perhaps for you, what we call the everyday, the mundane, is, or can be at least, the locus of sanctity. It's a potential anyway. It's because it's how we relate to the so-called ordinary world that matters. It's the eyes through which we look. And I'm just remembering that Jesus is often cited, isn't he, as saying in the Gospels, those who have ears, those who have eyes. And of course, he's not meaning the physical attributes, the physical organs. He means it seems to be about awareness and a looking in a different kind of a way. And Blake demonstrates the difference too, actually, centuries later, when he talks about some people seeing a tree, and for some people, it moves them to tears of joy, while to the eyes of others, it's just a green thing that stands in the way. So there are two different approaches that he's pointing out there. It's to do with the seeing, the beholding, the relationship. It's to do with consciousness and perception. Well, Need I say much about these? We see these on Facebook and social media, these little cartoons, just to remind us that life doesn't generally go to plan, and we have to fit in really with what actually happens. And as Robbie Burns says, the best laid schemes of mice and men gang after glay. Apparently that means the Scottish bit, gang after glay, is said is it means often go awry. The best laid plans or best laid schemes of mice and men often go awry. And yes, they do. So life's going awry is a fact. I think we can all agree on that. And we've probably all been faced with unexpected twists of fate, things that have happened that we definitely wouldn't have planned. They were not on our agendas, but they've happened. And so, life is as much a comedy as a tragedy, and in between it's a soap opera, and sometimes it's a farce, and on we go. All the world's a stage, as Shakespeare said. So given this fact and all that we encounter, the question that arises is, what are we going to do? What are we going to do about it? What are we going to do about this experience? We may not have choice in what happens, but we do have at least a little bit of choice in how we respond to it. Is there learning here for us? I always find that helpful to ask myself. Is there any learning in here for me? There's no doubt that we are gifted from pretty early on in life with what I call grist, our prima materia, our material, our content. And sometimes we start waking up to this around midlife. Not always, and I'm not really talking about chronological age, but at some point we start noticing a sense of wanting to start sifting through our life experience. And Dante's very famous quotation from the Inferno, in the middle of the journey of our life, I came to myself within a dark wood where the straight way was lost. This is so often quoted because I think we so often recognize that this waking up time, where we come to ourselves, in it feels bewildering. It can feel like, the metaphor of the dark wood. We've lost the path. We don't, you know. We're now in a different sort of territory to what we were. And the question is, can we trust this as a sort of rite of passage? So going back to the metaphor of windmills, grist to the mill and all that, as we know, mills separate wheat, the grain, from the chaff. The chaff is the husk, the outer protective casing. That's what kind of has to go. But it protects the inner, that which is capable of growing. And also it feeds us and therefore causes growth in us. If I mean, as it's nourishment, whether on the literal, as in food level, or in a metaphorical level. And there are real metaphors here that our life material is our grist, if we can see it that way. And our accruing of life experience seems to start calling to us, look at me, as if we're called to, at some point start doing the milling for ourselves. And I personally feel that this can grow us. And we then start to move into ground that we might start calling the spiritual, the sacred, and so on. And it seems to me we have a choice to be the millers of our own life experience. We can grow from it. Of course, none of this is guaranteed, and we so many people don't heed that call. But we can't hear the word, growing into wholeness. We can't hear that word whole without hearing holy as its echo, whole, holy. And, I personally have found this task of growing up to be quite a sacred task of becoming. The word whole and holy are linked together. There are so many words that are in the family of belonging, including, interestingly, to heal, being hale, being healthy, and all that, which I find deeply, deeply interesting. So life has shown me then that this is a project that we're all involved in, this grand tapestry called life, where we each are a thread of deep storyline interweaving with other deep storylines. We seem to be called to deepen. This is growing, this is transforming as human souls, rather away from being perfect personae, surfaces, into something possibly more scruffy and weather-worn, but we begin to feel something that we're part of something more than, or we can feel that. I've been feeling like that recently, and I've started calling my inner whatever, my I, my inner intelligence, which might be what, going back to the word daemon, spelt differently, means the same kind of thing, that inner something that seems to call us on in this kind of way. So we journey, and we tattify, we become tatty maybe, our hard edges get knocked off, and so on. But we, in a travel-worn sense, but yet we feel like we're on the move, as it were, inwardly. So I'm not fully sure precisely when it was that I first began to feel, actually really feel, inhabiting the feel of a pilgrim on life's path. But it did click into place around 2021. And it was as though my sort of centre of gravity shifted. And I guess you all might have been there at some point or other yourselves. For me, in 2021, I was faced with having a major operation. And during the build up to this operation, which took place in the summer of 2021, I experienced a real plunge into the deep depths of my psyche, which led me to really face up to my own mortality in a really felt sense. And the myth of Inanna resonated for me at that point. And what I found was I began to notice that what I called my identity badges, all the things that I was in the world, started dropping off. They loosened, and I felt as if I was called to examine everything I was. Really, it was, of course, a sifting process. It was me doing that. Is there still life in this for me? Whatever it was. And so during this kind of deep sea descent experience, because I had a image of needing to swim through a narrow underwater passage, that was the imagery that I had, really during that time, all my identities, university lecturer, blah, 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 I started to feel like I needed to sort of pick them up and look at them. And it really did feel like, the myth of Inanna, it felt like a stripping process. The myth of Inanna it's all about descending to the underworld, and she had to remove a garment of clothing at each level of descent until she's right at the deepest, point. And she's kind of waiting in the dark, hanging on a hook of all things, without hope. And it sounds pretty grim, I agree. But in actual fact, it really fitted what I was going through. And oddly enough, I began to trust it. And I can see it now as a really important, some kind of really important part of my inner process. And by the way, during this time, I found Unitarianism. So I was letting go of some things, but I was picking up as precious new things, you see. So it was very much a discerning time for me. And so I understand really this thing called life as something that we're all part of in this great unfolding mystery. And we're all intimately connected. And for me, creativity is central, however the creativity is expressed. And I consider it a sacred practice. And I don't mean sacred in the sense of like special, highfalutin and, out of the ordinary, but really right at the heart of, your sleeves rolled up kind of life. Where we're busy chopping wood and carrying water, as they say in Zen. And in this way, we are in cooperation, I feel, with the more universal creative forces, both within and without. And as a practice in paying attention, it helps to keep us in good heart. So, oh, I'm going to stop the share. I'm going to simply now say thank you very much for listening. I'm going to let Lizzie play the song that I thought might be nice right at the end here, which is a song that kind of came to me one morning. I kind of woke up with it and my husband put it to music, and it's called Marigold. And it's really what came from watching marigolds, the calendula, the humble little orange flower of summer. So thanks so much, Diolch yn fawr iawn. Thanks for listening and all the very best. Enjoy the rest of summer school. Thank you.
You've already heard Marigolds, you might have
No.
noticed. I didn't think that if I put the talks the other way around that they wouldn't flow. We all need some time to process, to reflect and to move. Nick is going to play the song that Fiona mentioned, Anthem. There's a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in. Nick will play that. The invitation to you is to write on your post-it a prayer for a part of yourself that needs healing and integration. It might be, please pray for my inner critic. Please pray for my sense of shame. Please help me rediscover my inner child. Please hold my, I'm trying to think of my many motherhood flaws in the light. Whatever part of you needs a little bit of love from us all, this is your chance to write that on the post-it. Nick will play music, move around, and then we'll bring this gathering to a close with the time of prayer. spirit of life and love, ground of our being, you who see us as our whole selves, we come into your presence now and offer up these prayers for ourselves and others, so that we might be healed by your grace and love. I pray for permission to feel comfortable with myself, to feel comfortable to not sit still and not be typical. Pray for the cracks in my body, mind and spirit. Pray the light will get in. Pray for all of us who feel or have been told that we are too much. Please love my angry, blunt and overwhelming presence. I love you. Please forgive me for any hurt. Assume good intent. Please help me shed my sense of being unwanted and not good enough. Let me just be. Please heal my sense of not really being seen or heard. As I enter a time of fearful and wonderful change, may I remember to trust the inner spark which connects me to the sacred in all. Namaste. I pray for healing from the pain of some of my actions when bringing up my children and the effect they have had on them. Please help me to find more varied and wonderful purposes in the decades of my life ahead. Love me when I fall short of the standards I can meet. May I find forgiveness for my failings as a father. Please release what no longer serves my soul's journey. Please help me find forgiveness. And please pray for all the parts that need to be rescued from the mud, cleansed in the well water and warmed by the sun. For all of the words and all those that remain on our hearts. Amen. The time will come, the time will come when with elation you will greet yourself arriving at your own door in your own mirror, and each will smile at the other's welcome and say, sit here, eat. You will love again the stranger who was yourself. Give wine, give bread, give back your heart to itself, to the stranger who has loved you all your life, whom you ignored for another, who knows you by heart. Take down the love letters from the bookshelf, the photographs, the desperate notes. Peel your own image from the mirror. Sit. Feast on your life. And so we come to the end of this time together. Nick has been practicing anthem and playing it very gently in the background the whole time when you walked in and with the prayer. And now we have it on Spotify with the lyrics on the board, so you can have a sing along. But mindful of time, if you need to slip quietly away, that's absolutely fine as well. And thank you so much for being people that I could tell my story to.
The birds, they sang at the break of day. Start again, I heard them say. Don't dwell on what has passed away or what is yet to be. No drugs.